Qualitative Conversations. Today we join Kakali Bhattacharya, Professor of Research Evaluation and Methodologies at the University of Florida. Professor Bhattacharya is the new editor of the journal Departures in Critical Qualitative Research. We join her today with guest interviewer James Salvo.
Welcome, Kakali.
Thank you. Thank you. Happy to be here.
So you're the new editor of Departures in Critical Qualitative Research. Could you tell us how you got involved with the journal?
Sure. So prior to my being an editor, the previous editor, Dr. Devika Chawla, had invited me a couple of times to write for the journal, and I had written for the journal. I would say that Devika gave me a lot of intellectual freedom to write whichever way I wanted, and that really allowed me to flourish as a qualitative researcher, as a critical and a creative qualitative researcher, take chances, be experimental. So I really enjoyed that and discovered different ways of writing that were creative, critical, nonfiction, experimental. So that's what I was doing. And then when Devika's term was up, she alerted me to her term being up and she asked me to consider applying for it. And so then I applied and then I got it.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. Yeah. So going forward in the journal, are there things either continued or perhaps new? What sorts of things do you envision the journal accomplishing?
Yeah. So the journal has a history of being more in the liberal arts humanities area, which I think is fantastic because my home college is education, and education sits in this liminal space of between social science and humanities. You know, a lot of us do social science-oriented research qualitatively, and a lot of us do qualitative inquiry that is more humanities-oriented work as well. So in this intersection, I think a lot of educational researchers didn't see DCQR as a place for their pieces. And so what I'd really like to do is expand the readership of DCQR so that we can bring educational researchers into the fold too, who might find themselves kind of a non-fit from a very traditional educational research perspective. And especially if they're doing critical, creative work that is interdisciplinary, that integrates some of the humanities as well, then this is a really good home for them too. So I think a lot of folks that are doing that type of work are always looking for where can I publish? So DCQR is a really good home for work like that. It attracts very high quality writing and brave intellectual work, I would say.
So you mentioned that you're really open to critical, creative, interdisciplinary work. As an editor, are there other things that you value?
Yeah, so Departures is Departures in Critical Qualitative Research often is a space for disruption, you know, disrupting status quo, disrupting traditional ways in which qualitative research has been written, disrupting certain, you know, Western-oriented colonialistic thinking, and disrupting various structures of oppression globally as well. So the previous editors before me had already laid out some really good foundation on this and have, you know, a local, national, and globally situated perspective of disruption. And I want to continue that, but I also want to continue methodological disruption as well, in addition to the kind of work that has been done. And the thing that I think is my signature into the time that I'm going to be an editor is to also bring in discussions about healing. So a lot of times we talk about this justice-oriented work that we do, but we don't always consider that the fatigue, the burnout comes from engaging in some of this justice-oriented work. And so once we disrupt structures and have our hammer and break things down, you know, when you are looking at the ruins of whatever, you have to honor the energy drainage that came for you. And you have to honor the pain that comes from bearing witness to struggle and suffering, yours or group of people that you're working with or that you're in community with. And so justice work without healing work feels incomplete to me. So I think healing work has to be an integral part of justice work so that we can draw strength from our healing to continue on doing justice work. So that is something that I want to bring forward. And the other thing that I want to bring forward is a more spirit integrated way of knowing. So it's a more wholeness oriented way of knowing. So when other places might think that, oh, that's going too far, that's not academic enough, I want to be a welcoming place for people who have a spirit integrated way of knowing and being and doing that work. And I'm certainly not the first one to say that. Gloria Anzaldúa has talked about spiritual activism. Cynthia Dillard has written plenty about it. So I want to have a journal space where that kind of thinking is connected to critical work is welcomed as well.
Wonderful. So I'll ask you a little bit more about the types of manuscripts that you seek. So I know you talked about being open to people who take more of a spiritual orientation and consider healing and justice together. Are there any other things that you might seek in a manuscript?
Yeah, so in the manuscript, you know, the DCQR has its own scope and all of that. So it doesn't have to always be spirit integrated or healing integrated, but it just wasn't a focus of previous iterations. So I'm just adding that in addition to the great work that the previous editors have done for the issue. But anything that, for me, anything that takes a departure, you know, whether it be theoretical, methodological, ontological, epistemological, that informs a critical qualitative research agenda is what I'm looking for. And that I don't want to put a structure around it. I want it to be as open as possible. I want people to feel as intellectually free as I felt when I was writing for Devika when she was the editor. And I want to sort of model that people have a lot of intellectual freedom as long as they can argue a departure of some sort and within the realm of critical qualitative research. And both of those realms are really broadly defined with many schools of thought. So, you know, so I'm keeping it loose just so that we can have a lot of intellectual freedom and the scholars and the authors who write can shape it as they understand, you know, those ideas and terms.
Yeah, I think that kind of organic approach, I mean, it really sounds like that you have a writer's journal, if you will. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes, that's a really good way of saying it. It's a writer's journal, yes.
So can you tell us more about ideas for people who are thinking of submitting to the journal about the sorts of contributions that they might be able to make?
Yeah, so the first, so we are putting together the upcoming issue that is sort of curated by the previous editorial team. So that's coming up that, you know, Devika and her team had already put that together. But then after that, I have a themed issue that's coming out about liminality and discomfort, but discomfort is a sliced word, like this sliced comfort of people's multiple positions that they find themselves in as a result of the pandemic, you know, like with the lens of, you know, how have they understood their home and work, or, you know, first world and developing nations, whatever the case may be, wherever their liminal locations are, and what level of comfort and discomfort have come up for them for this. So that is upcoming as sort of maybe two issues. We had a lot of submissions and people are submitting beautiful pieces for bringing together art and poetry and criticality and identity, you know, and so I'm excited to see what this unfolds. But moving forward, I think there's always opportunities for people to author their own special issues, edit their own special issues. So I'm looking forward to people proposing special issues as well. And that takes a whole other realm of possibility of what people would bring to the table. But beyond that, I think that I'm really open to work that helps us shift our thinking about something, you know, whether it be methodology theory, ways we represent data, ethics, positionality, reflectivity, issues about colonialism, heteropatriarchy, homophobia, Islamophobia, anti-Blackness, you know, anything that are like issues that are local, national, global issues, and people want to tackle that with some level of methodological look into it, you know, is what I am excited to welcome and expand our conversation in that. Because I think that especially in this current moment where CRT has been under attack, it gives us an opportunity to double down and say critical qualitative research is important and necessary and life force of people's work and people's existence. And so instead of shrinking, this offers us the opportunity to expand it. And critical work can be CRT. Critical work can be more than CRT too. So it allows us to collectively come together and say, we're not backing down. We are going to discuss racialized oppression. We are going to discuss white supremacy. We are going to discuss dismantling these things. And whether we call it CRT or whether we frame it through another lens, anti-oppressive lens, we're not backing down on this.
Yeah, that's I think that's so good for authors to have a place where they can not be afraid to take a stand for social justice. Mm-hmm. So that's wonderful. Now, you also mentioned special issues. I know you wear a lot of hats, so you're editor of Departures, but I know you've put together numerous special issues. Do you have any advice for someone perhaps thinking about putting together a special issue and what all that entails?
Yeah, sure. It's the biggest challenge I find with special issue is to keep everybody on schedule. I find that to be the biggest challenge with special issues because everybody's life changes. And then I tried to put together 3 special issues during the last 2 years. And it took a really long time for those to come to fruition because people's lives changed. I moved cross country myself, so I had to pause. Health issues came up for people. They had to pause. People gave birth. People had deaths. And so it takes some time from conception to actual publication. So I would say that if somebody wants to do special issues, to be really realistic and realize like whatever the time frame they think they can do it, add another year to it at least. You know, just add another year because stuff's going to happen and authors going to need extension and people's lives are going to happen. So you're going to have some flexibility to it. So I would say just to kind of not burn out, you know, and realize, oh, somebody was supposed to submit and they didn't submit. What do I do? Because they can't submit at all. You know, I would say that it's helpful to have some backup plans, you know, except a little bit more, except if you want to publish 6, maybe accept 8. And somebody usually falls off and says, sorry, I can't do it. You know, have word count that gives you some wiggle room if somebody goes over, you know, or if somebody didn't submit, you know, or somebody wrote short, you know, have some wiggle room for word count. I guess I'm mostly saying have flexibility built into that because not everybody's going to behave the same way. Not everyone's going to follow your instruction exactly the way you did it. In fact, some people will take huge pride in not following a single one of your instructions, you know, and just know how you might want to roll with that as you're rolling with that. But most importantly, I think it's important to have a vision and communicate that vision to the authors, because when the articles are coming in and that vision is not exacted, it ends up very hard to write an editorial intro. Then these articles, you can't thread these articles properly because there's somebody writing here, somebody writing here, somebody writing here, because your vision is not, it's not authors, it's you as the editor, your vision wasn't clear. So it's super important to have a clear vision for the theme and what kind of questions you want to explore in the theme and have that fleshed out really well and make sure when you're doing rounds and rounds of editorial review, you know, before you send out to peer review, that you have done your due diligence to make sure those articles are aligned with the theme that you wanted to do.
I think that's wonderful advice, especially to build in not only buffer time, but buffer space and really have everyone focus at the outset. So you've just shared with us some of your thoughts about editing special issues. Do you have any thoughts that you'd like to share with us about being an editor?
Well, I'm also the editor of my Rutledge series called Futures of Data Analysis and Qualitative Research. And well, Rutledge is a mixed bag, you know, it just depends on who you get. I have a good managing editor, obviously, who I have a very good working relationship with. But, you know, most of my authors who submit books to my series are often themselves multiply marginalized. and they're also writing for and from a multiply marginalized perspective. And it's always hard to get reviewers, and reviewers also a mixed bag. And so sometimes you'll see that a reviewer might say, I know nothing about Black feminist thought or intersectionality, but, and then they go on to trash the work. And I'm like, how is that acceptable? How is that acceptable in any world if you position yourself not an expert, but then you want to have an expert voice for critique? You know, like those two things don't go together. They're just sort of a very large contradiction, but people feel very entitled to critique things that they don't understand really well, you know? So I often stand between my author and those reviewers as the editor, so that I can tell that my authors, ignore that part of that. You don't need to address that. So because there have been times when I have been an author and the editor made us write, my co-author and I write, co-editor and I write, we were writing an edited text. And so the, you know, publishing house made us respond to reviewers who made super racist reviews. And we had to write, by the time I rage responded, you know, responded from a place of high rage, you know, it ended up being like a 10-page paper because I had a lot of rage to express. And so righteous rage, but a lot of righteous rage with a lot of words to express my righteous rage. And I realized after that, like how much time and labor my co-editor and I put in to neutralize this type of thing that shouldn't even have been on our radar. There should have been somebody that says, this is bullshit. We don't need the authors to address this, you know, and that didn't happen. And so I want to sort of be the editor I wish somebody was for me. You know, so I don't want people to have to deal with feedback that is not necessarily feedback that is constructive, that is helpful, that can build and strengthen the piece, that can sharpen the craft. If it's not doing that, then my authors don't need to handle that. The other thing that I do, even as an editor for my editorial feedback, I let the author know that they are highly agentic. My reading is only one reading as an editor, and they decide how much of my reading they get to, how much of my feedback they want to incorporate and what they don't want to incorporate. And I don't take it personally if they didn't incorporate something, because I trust that they know what is best for the spirit of their work. But really the task there is that if you know that this interpretation can exist from your writing, as an author, I want you to sit with that and say, are you okay with that interpretation? And sometimes you are okay because you're writing for a culturally inside audience and you don't care what the cultural outsider audience interprets. And sometimes you're okay and sometimes you're not okay because you say, no, I don't want interpretation to live. So whatever I can do to address that in advance, preemptively, I want to address that. But that's, I trust my authors completely to have the agency to write whichever way they want to write. The only thing in that series that I want people to do is to make methodological contributions because it's a methodological series. And usually they do. I do get, you know, a lot of times I think as an editor, the tip that I want to offer people is before you submit some request for, you know, a special issue or an editorial issue, please make sure you match what you're doing to the focus of the series or the issue or whatever. And I think a lot of people struggle thinking methodologically. If they think if they've used a methodology, then it's methodological, you know. So if it's an applied methodology, they think it's methodological. But those of us who work in methodology see methodological contributions very differently, you know. So for example, if somebody comes in and says, this is methodological because it allowed me to understand my subjectivities and positionities, you know, most of us are like, that's not cutting it, because that's what you do in every qualitative research. So even if you came to the realization and it was like very powerful for you, which it could be, it needs to be a little bit more than, you know, I was reflexive and I understood some stuff by being reflexive, you know. So I find like that, if folks are submitting for methodological series or methodological special issues, the tip that I would have for you then is to go beyond thinking through the applied lens of qualitative research and think of methodology as a discipline. You know, what are you contributing to methodology as a discipline?
Yeah, I think that's wonderful advice. And I think you also offered really good advice that we need to hear as reviewers of manuscripts. I recall one of my one of the professors that I had way back when in grad school just kind of gave us this general advice. You know, if you're going to critique something, you need to have spent at least 10 years with it. I think that's an important thing to remember.
And that's why when I have manuscripts that come through, I might have some good working knowledge of it, but you know, it may not be completely in my wheelhouse, but I'm reading it as a friendly critical reader. So this is why I always say this is just one reading, use as you see fit, because I don't want the author to think that somehow I have more of an expert voice than they have. You know, I don't want to position myself hierarchically like that with an author's work, because the spirit of the work resides with the author. The author is the agentic voice of their work. You know, I don't want to manipulate that voice. I want to enhance that voice as best as I can with my reading of the work, but I want to make sure that the author has full intellectual freedom without fear of penalty to accept whatever they can accept from my reading of it.
Yeah, I really think that you're the writer's editor. That's wonderful. Speaking of writing, do you have any personal insights about writing that you'd like to share?
Sure. Writing is never about writing. It's never about the act of writing. And I've shared this in many other places. It's not about the act of like how fast you can type, how sophisticated your thinking is, how many theory books you have read, you know, how many methodology books you have read, how many conferences you've gone to. Nothing. None of that is about writing. Writing is about self-expression, and writing is about voice, and writing is about creating matter, because you write, your writing now exists in some space that people can print out, and it has now taken up space and you have made matter out of it. You know, from your thoughts, it's matter now, you know, and writing is kind of magical, because here's you putting together a string of words in whatever way you want to. And there's the reader whose knowledge and position shifts as a result of connecting to your thoughts and your writing and your connection of ideas together. And that to me is pure magic, that, you know, I think these things and I am courageous enough to put it down in the most compelling way that I can. And somebody else no longer thinks what they used to think because they read my piece, and their world opened up and their awareness opened up because of it. So I feel like writing is the last magic left on earth, you know, along with other creative modalities like, you know, music and dance and play and all of that. But writing is self-expression. And a lot of times in academia, you know, we are trained to think like stay in your lane, don't express yourself this way or that way, or these are the precedence to how you express yourself academically versus these other things. And along with this comes all the other stories we carry about who we are and how we show up and how we express ourselves. And if we want to, I mentor people. I have a mentoring program and I mentor people. And so one of the questions I ask them, or one of the sentences I ask them to complete is, if I show up in my fullness in my writing, I fear that. And that's when people start telling me what they fear. I fear that people will not take me seriously. I fear that people will say this is not academic. I fear that I will not be enough, you know? So I fear that I will be punished. It will be unsafe. So somewhere along the line of our being and becoming, we have stories that we have told ourselves about self-expression. And maybe we have also learned expressing yourself fully is dangerous. Expressing yourself fully has consequences. So temper it down, tone it down, center yourself a little bit, draw this boundary around you, then you're safe. That'll camouflage you from attacks. So people are carrying multiple different narratives, fear of being seen, fear of being unseen, fear of rejection, fear of abandonment, fear of not being good enough, you know, all of this fear of failure. And of course, imposter syndrome, you know, so there's just a lot of different things people carry with them. So if you are going to write, you have to kind of get in touch with those detrimental narratives that are living in your body and your being. Because when you let them go and you neutralize, you can receive more. You can receive more inspiration. You can receive more ideas. You can have an expanded awareness with which you can now have deeper insights, because you're blocked otherwise. Your flow is blocked if you have all of these stories living in you and it's continuously in tension and you're trying to rise above it to find like an expansive voice with which you want to cultivate deep critical insight. And so the more you can release some of these stories, the more expansive your thinking will become and the more fuller way you would express yourself in your work. And there are people waiting to hear from you in that way. There are people that are waiting for you to be more fuller version of you so that they feel like they have the permission to do the same for themselves.
Yeah. Is there anywhere that we can go to find more about your work? I know you mentioned the mentoring project.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's on my website. So it's kakali.org. And then there's a link there called Work With Me. So I have a program that's coming up in summer. It's going to be a 10-week, about 3.5 months, I want to say, mentoring program where we're going to work through detrimental narratives that we have internalized. And we're going to work through some of the ways that we can change our neural networks that we have built through those detrimental narratives to different neural networks, to noticing patterns that are more restorative and creating more restorative patterns for ourselves, because, you know, I'm all about the healing part too. And we're going to create a map of our ways of being and knowing in this world, a visual map of it with different domains on it. And then once we have that, we're going to understand how who we are and what we are becoming fits academic work that we do versus force fit ourselves to the academic work. And so folks are then going to do a skill building work, whether it be to write a book chapter, write an article. That's going to be a 10-week process after the foundational work we do on neutralizing these detrimental narratives. So then we're going to finish up a project, an academic project, and I'm going to give them feedback. And it's about a 10-week process of the feedback that they're going to submit things and get feedback from me. So I just wanted to have this wholeness-centered, nurturing, mentoring scenario where we're not just doing the skill building without the detrimental narrative portion of it, you know, because the skill building itself, there's lots of conferences that have lots of professional development stuff. But what folks are not talking about is how does the whole being show up? And usually the whole being doesn't show up in the writing. A fragmented portion of us show up in the writing. And I'm challenging that to say, when a fragmented portion show up in our writing and in our work, then the other pieces of us that are being silenced, that energy has to go somewhere. And that repressed energy can sometimes create more stress, and stress can create health issues, stress can create relationship issues. You know, a lot of us have those experiences. So I kind of want to have more wellness-oriented way for people to do the work so that they don't burn out and have fatigue. So it's called S2S Mentoring. That is coming up in summer that I'm doing. S2S stands for Strength to Strength or Struggle to Strength. People can define it however they want to. I'm leaving that open.
Yes. Well, Kakali, thank you so much for your insights and your generosity in creating a space where writers can tell their stories.
Thank you.